It's 10 minutes after 12. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Friday edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in today. You can follow me on Twitter, you know, at Steve Bertrand, or on Facebook as well. A week ago, Amina Alahi from Blue Sky Innovation was in Austin, Texas, and we were talking to her on the telephone as she was getting set to go in and listen to President Obama address the gathering. And she joins us now in the studio a week later to digest everything that she picked up in Austin. Welcome to the studio, Amina.
Thank you.
So let's start with the president. I mean, was it what you expected? I mean, did he make any sort of great sort of tremors there? I think it was the first time a sitting president ever addressed the group.
It was, and people were really excited about that. I mean, just the energy in the crowd was palpable in terms of people lining up for hours ahead of time to get a chance to see him speak. But in terms of what he said, I think it was mostly expected. He was really making a call for people who work in technology and are skilled in sort of those areas to come up with solutions and new ways to solve civic problems, and particularly to improve civic engagement. He talked about online voting and the fact that, you know, we could probably figure out a way to get there.
You know, so events like this, South by Southwest, everyone is there with a pitch, right? You've got the developers with the pitch. You've got the consumers maybe with the pitch. You've got cities with the pitch. Chicago was down there making a pitch. How did they do?
They did an interesting job. I mean, I think the how did they do question is different. You know, the answer is different depending on who you ask. Some people who showed up at the lounge event that I went to that they had on Monday felt like, hey, this is a nice place to kind of meet people from Chicago, bump into some interesting folks, and others kind of had stumbled upon it and were there for free beer.
Well, the idea was, instead of being in the main venue, they set up their sort of little outdoor area across from the main venue with the notion that people would come in and relax a little bit more.
Exactly. And that's a very typical thing to do down there. A lot of different cities and even countries had their sort of respective booths or houses. A lot of them were in the exhibition area, which Chicago has done in the past. But that's really expensive, and you have to do that for a whole week. So this approach was just one day. They're also having a music showcase. You know, they had one yesterday. So I think they were trying to concentrate their efforts in one place. The people who were at the lounge seemed to be really enjoying it. They had free burgers and Lagunitas, and that was fun for everyone. But when you look at what a city like Washington, D.C. did, they really blew it out. They had a huge house.
It's so funny you say that, because yeah. I was just going to say, Chicago spent, what, 25 grand maybe?
They said they might even be coming under budget.
And WEDC was what they called themselves. Washington, D.C. spent 375 last year and probably more this year.
Right. And it's not surprising. I mean, they were there for the whole 5 days of the interactive festival, huge house and patio with a DJ booth right outside the convention center, kind of in the main way of traffic. So that kind of exposure comes with a high price tag.
And like you said, it's hard to gauge what the, I mean, you're planting seeds, maybe building for future relationships. It's not like you're selling Easter lilies at Target. You know, you're not going to measure exactly how you did. So hopefully it will have worked out for them. They had a hashtag, right? Chicago Made. How did that fare?
They did. It didn't get used all too much outside of their booth, although, or rather their lounge. They did have a vending machine that was powered by tweets. So if you went up and used Chicago Made and a specific code that it gave you, it would spit out a prize. So the most frequent prizes I saw were Cards Against Humanity packs and T-shirts. So people like that.
The big thing was virtual reality again. Everyone's been talking about that for a couple of years.
That's right. I mean, this was a year where there was no sort of one app that took over that everyone was saying you had to download. But a lot of the bigger brands and companies had virtual reality opportunities. So you could go, you know, experience a roller coaster or sit in a NASCAR, you know, racing car and be on the track. And so I think people were really enjoying and excited about that, because some of the products are actually going to be available for sale this year.
I mean, and it's going to be a big deal. I mean, it's just a matter of the time, right, before we have a virtual reality set of goggles, probably in most of our homes.
Right, although there are questions as to how many people will actually buy them based on the price point and that sort of thing. It isn't going to be a cheap endeavor, at least not at first.
Not now, right.
Right. So it'll take time for it to catch on, but I think that this year you saw some potential for how people might use it.
All right, so you wrote about this one thing, sounds really cool, Entrium 4D.
Right.
An Entrium 4D headset. which basically shocks behind your ears a little bit to simulate movement?
Essentially. So this is a product that's a prototype from Samsung's Innovation Lab. So whether it comes to market remains to be seen. But you put on the VR headset, you put on these big over-ear headphones, and in the back of the sort of part that goes over your ears, there's a little pad on each side, and it sends a current through the back of your head.
Right.
And they use that electrical current to sync up with whatever video you're watching. So in my case, it was a race car. And when the car takes a turn, you feel like you're swaying with it.
Because of the way your head is being shocked.
Exactly. It's a crude way of putting it, but yeah. Yeah.
It's sort of Clockwork Orange sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it tricks you into feeling like you're moving.
And so I'm wondering, you know, if movie theaters are going to go away, if we're going to start watching our movies on virtual reality, where we could go to any, I mean, we can go to a den, but you could go to any sort of public room, rent these, watch the movies together, be shocked together, you know, and no longer will we see the big screen.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, although you have to think that when you have a virtual reality headset on, you can look in any direction. So maybe the character's in front of you, but I could be watching behind me and miss something important. So I think that's going to be a question that filmmakers are going to have to answer.
Right, so feature film really wouldn't work for virtual reality.
Right, maybe it changes the way that we experience feature films altogether.
I can't believe this guy who owns the Happy Lobster food truck drove all the way to Austin, Texas, and you refused to have a lobster roll.
Well, Austin, Texas is kind of a mecca for food trucks.
How
I had to
tacos,
try what they had there. Oh, I had so many tacos. Probably 4 or 5 times I had tacos.
Nice.
They're so good.
All right, tell me about the owner of the Happy Lobster, though. He was invited by South by Southwest, drove all the way down there to sell his lobster rolls. Lobster rolls. So it's not like, you know, he's got a back full of nachos or something. He had to get lobster shipped in sort of remotely to make it work.
Right. And he does that here. I mean, his food truck is out on the streets of Chicago. He has lobster shipped in daily fresh from Maine. So he had to kind of reorganize all of his logistics to get the lobster shipped to Austin. He had to find a new bread supplier because the ones he was finding were not satisfactory. So the closest one he could find was someone in Austin who was then driving it in every day.
But it worked. He said he made a lot of money.
It worked. I mean, he wouldn't tell me exactly how much he was making, but he said compared to some of the events they've done in Chicago, they were doing way better, and he expected to more than break even.
Amina Alahi, reporter for Blue Sky Innovation. Thanks for coming in today. I enjoyed talking to you the last couple of weeks.
Thank you. Likewise.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is a Friday afternoon in Chicago. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for listening. And as you know, I got to check the scores, actually. My daughter goes to Dayton, and they started the tournament off today with a game against Syracuse. Who would know the score? Who would
I
know
do.
The do you?
Dayton's
what's the score?
Only down by 2 points at the half.
Oh,
Syracuse 30, Dayton 28.
Actually, I was thinking Tom Gimbel might know the score because I think all day today he's just watching the tournament. Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network. Tom, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve, don't spread the word out there that I don't work. Come on, man.
Is that what's going on? Is that why you're not in the studio? Because you're watching the games?
We may have some clients over at our office watching the game and having a few adult beverages.
I got to tell you, so we kind of fell into this. I want to talk to you about politics in the workplace.
Yeah.
But honestly, today, we had Philip Weiss in here earlier this week from Seyfarth Shaw at Work, and he was talking about how you get your employees to manage the tournament and still get productivity out of it. And you sort of given up the fight, right? You're just having a party all day long.
No, you know what? I've done it a little bit differently. So what I do is I create a company involvement where, A, we entertain our clients and have them come over, but, B, we still have our goals, and I still manage with accountability, and my managers manage their team with accountability. So people know that they have work to get done, and some partake more and earlier, and some are doing work, and people really allocate. Some folks want to be socializing, and others want to get their stuff done. So it's kind of, if people know what they have to do, giving them some flexibility to have some fun and enjoy the tournament isn't a bad thing.
Yeah, well, that's my thing. I always think is you got to make the workplace fun to go to, your job fun to go to, and sometimes that might involve a less productive day or two.
Absolutely. You're going to have them anyways. Life is hard. Let's make it a little bit more fun at work.
All right, so it's not often fun when people start talking politics, and it's probably happened quite a bit this cycle. You know, we do a podcast with John Williams and Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie. It's called The Mincing Rascals. And every Friday, I do the news at 11 on WGN, then I rush and we record this podcast, and then I come here and do the show. So it's kind of a busy time. But anyway, I just left it. And one of the things we're talking about is how involved everyone is now in politics this year. You might not like Donald Trump, but you're talking about him, or Hillary Clinton, but you're talking about her. What do you do when that starts spilling over into the workplace?
So I'm a big believer that, number one, you need to know your office environment, right? And so if people are open and communicative and talking, if it's one of those places where no one ever talks about religion and no one ever talks about race and no one, then it's probably not a safe zone. However, if you're in a place that people are collegial and people talk to each other, when you're the person that says, I'm not going to talk about it because you are so one side or the other, you're actually, by not talking about it, you're creating the wall. You're creating more of a problem than by listening and actually sharing and wanting to learn about other people's views.
Yeah, but it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, it tells me a lot when someone's willing to engage in a conversation about politics with someone with whom they disagree, because that tells me that they're open, that they can have a discussion
exactly.
Without becoming too emotional. And just the opposite is true as well. If someone's not capable, then I don't really value their opinion that much.
I don't disagree with you, and I think that's – so when people don't want to engage and they say, I don't want to, they've already engaged. They've already sent a message of how they communicate, how they listen, how they absorb. And I got to tell you, it translates over to business. Are you open to other people's ideas? Are you open to your clients who disagree with you? Are you open to employees who have different perspectives on how to tackle things? Blue or red, Republican or Democrat, it's just one aspect of what we deal with in our daily life.
And so what do you do if it becomes a problem in the workplace as a manager?
If it becomes an issue, I'll tell you this. I was having a management team meeting the other day, and I said, as we're leaving, I go, hey, if anybody wants to stay and have a free-for-all conversation about the political stuff, feel free to stay. If you don't want to, feel free to leave. I could care less. And everybody stayed, and we just, everybody said who the one person out of the, four or six final people were, and we just talked and laughed, and we all knew what everybody's leanings were anyway.
Right.
I mean, this really shouldn't be too big of a shock to anybody if somebody's a Hillary person or a Donald person.
So you did have that free exchange, and there were people
absolutely.
Yeah, that's
absolutely
great.
And we make fun of people for it.
I think that's less and less likely anymore, unfortunately. So that's good for you. Kudos to you that you can do that in your office. But not today. Let's just talk about mascots, bad calls, overtime, and sweating
all
coaches.
All day long, right?
That's right. Scott, or Tom Gimbel, the CEO and founder of the LaSalle Network. I understand you're going to honor Yun Tai, who's going to be over there a little bit later, too.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you this. We're going to do some things for Special Olympics, and it's exciting for us to be able to give back on the philanthropic side. And Special Olympics does such a good thing for those kids and those families. And the goal is to give back.
Have a great time, Tom. I appreciate it. And thanks for the invite. I hope I can make it next year.
Good talking to you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Scott Kleinberg is in the studio. He writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
It's a nice day out there, sort of a day. A lot of people might go out for a jog.
They might, yes.
And if they were to go out for a jog in Chicago, the air quality is much better than it used to be.
Yep, for sure.
No reason to wear a face mask or anything like that.
I wouldn't think so, no.
Now, my friend, if you are in Beijing or Peking, as some of the older people call it, you should be wearing a mask, right?
Yes.
Now, Mark Zuckerberg is in Beijing, goes out for a run. Now, I would almost think that the Chinese might see this as embracing or defiant, that I'm here with you, I'm embracing who you are.
Yeah.
But he catches flack for going out for a jog and not protecting his lungs.
Yes, because the situation with air pollution there is apparently so bad that is the dire warning that you have to wear a mask. And it's gone from bad to worse just this week alone. So, yeah, so he's out there without the mask.
Okay, so he is. Crazy. But so why are the Chinese people offended by him doing that?
They're offended because the whole reason why he's there, Facebook is banned in China. He's there because he's trying to get it unbanned. He's trying to build good relationships with the Chinese. He is married to someone who is Chinese. He's trying to do all these great things. He knows Mandarin. He's very, very smart when it comes to that. But he's jogging without this mask, and there are people on Twitter saying really, really smart things like, here's a guy who wants to embrace and know our culture, yet he doesn't know anything about us. And
it's wild.
It's really wild. And it's true because everybody around him is wearing his mask and he's just like nothing's going on.
Okay, so I spent some time studying communist politics back when, you know, the Soviet Union and all that.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear that, I think, oh, that's the government putting those things out to sort of diminish him, to make him not look good. Is there any evidence of that?
No, it doesn't look like
people.
That at all. These are just regular people that are just out there saying, you know, hey, this is something that you should know better and you shouldn't be doing.
Is there an emoji for that, Scott?
No, but there is a there is a smiley with a face mask.
See?
But it's technically for being sick, not really for air pollution. However, I think it would be fine to use it in
this
situation.
I think it's adaptable in this case.
Yes.
Now, you talked a while ago about how in Facebook Messenger you could play chess, right? There's a hidden chess game.
Yes.
And now March Madness is underway and they've got a hoops game?
Yes. And you're supposed to play with a friend, and it's very well hidden. If you type in the basketball emoji to a friend and you hit send, if you tap on the basketball, you get this game. And I did it really, really quick, and I haven't really played to see how well I can do, but you basically get a white screen and a hoop and a basketball. And you have to move the phone around using the accelerometer in the phone to try to get a basket. And then if you get one, you get a happy emoji or different kinds of emojis that are happy. If you miss it, you get sad emojis. So it's all about emojis. Very, very wonderful thing.
You've got game?
Well, I mean, I tried it really quick and I didn't do very well. I need to do it this weekend when I have a little bit more time.
I do not play games on my phone other than solitaire or, you know.
I do war games. That's really all I do.
But you just described it, so you're holding the phone flat and you're tilting it to make the ball move?
Yep.
So it's almost like that little, remember the game with the little ball bearing where you try to get it in the slots?
Oh, yes. I used to love that. So I have a feeling I would be really good at this. Now, apparently when you get to 10 baskets, it starts to move around the backboard.
Right.
When you get to 20, it goes even faster. I'm curious to see how well I can do it.
How funny that we have new technology to play our old games.
Yeah.
In so many ways. I mean, I play solitaire. It's what I do. And this is a little gizmo that 5-year-olds used to play with.
There's that. And now you can play Pong on your Apple Watch.
Nice.
Which is, I don't even know how that works. But hey, I just like the fact that it can be done.
I'm sure someone was calling for that.
Of course.
While we're talking about Apple, you know, they're engaged in this fight with the FBI about encryption. And they want to get into the phone of, you know, one of the terrorists in San Bernardino, but there are also many other. I mean, there are a couple in Chicago.
Yep.
Police are holding phones. I think 150 or more in New York, they're holding phones.
Yep.
And if the FBI wins this case and Apple is forced to really build their own code to get around their encryption, that's what they'd have to do.
Yeah.
What would compel could an Apple engineer just play dumb and say, I can't figure it out? And then
they could do that, and according to what a lot of people are saying, the Apple engineers would step down and quit before they did it. And whether you agree with it or disagree with it, the reason why they would do that is because they are the people who have actually wrote the code to make you safe. And now they're saying, take the code that you wrote and change it. And a lot of these people, from what we're hearing, would not want to be a part of that.
So it's more than just a job and a paycheck to them. I mean,
it's how they feel. And, you know, some reports even say that it would almost be a badge of honor. Like, you could be hired anywhere if you're willing to say, I'm going to stand up for that and I'm not going to do it.
It is an interesting thing. I mean, so they built a fortress and now they might be compelled to build some weak spots in that fortress.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the case is fascinating in its own right, but you never really think about the actual people that Tim Cook would have to go to and say, hey, okay, this is what we've been dealt. Now do this. And, you know, whether or not he agrees with whether they would do that or not, I don't know. But it's interesting to think about.
Couldn't any of those scientists who might walk away, couldn't they also start to work for the bad guys and develop a way through the encryption?
Oh, I'm sure anybody could.
Right.
This kind of thing, yeah.
Well, then I don't know where that argument flies then, because then it's not that super secret if one coder could build a way through, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they could figure out how to do it. But a lot of these people are truly Apple loyalists. A lot of these people have been there, you know, for a long time since the Steve Jobs
day. Right.
And they feel a very certain, you know, grasp and connection to the company.
Fascinating story.
It
and
really
it's
is.
Not over yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to something a little more frivolous, or maybe not. Let's have a Domino's pizza, right?
Yeah.
They're working on a robot that will deliver the pizza to me.
Yeah, they're working on this thing in New Zealand that is an actual robot that can travel 12 and a half miles or something like that. And it can carry up to 10 pizzas. And It's totally meant to be completely automatic.
Its name is Drew.
Yes.
Do we know what that stands for?
The, I wrote it down. Domino's Pizza Robotic Unit.
Drew. Okay.
Yes. So it's not happening yet. It's one of those things where they have, you know, models of it in production. It's kind of like the self-driving cars. You know, they're out there, but they're not, you know, fully out there yet. But, you know, and it has a code, which I think is a really cool
I was going to ask you. So if I'm some young rascal shooting hoops on my phone or otherwise, and I see Drew rolling by at 12 miles, and I'm going to think, hey, there's 10 hot pizzas in there.
Yep. Apparently it has
Why couldn't I make friends with Drew and get his pizza?
Apparently it has some kind of super special code that encrypts it and locks it, and only the customer has it. Sounds like kind of like a pizza robot ATM kind of thing,
right?
Which, you know,
is it a homing robot? Because Drew has to get home too.
It knows how to get back to the store, and it goes back, and then it recharges itself, and it gets ready for the next trip.
Is there I almost said pie in the sky. I did not even mean that, but I mean, how concrete is the possibility of this one day?
Oh, but they already have working prototypes of it, so it seems like it's very concrete. It's just the question of, you know, how fast can they do it? How efficient can they do it? So you have pizza robots delivering your pizza, drones delivering your Amazon stuff. You know, it's just all going to be this crazy robotic future, self-driving cars.
So we can stay home and play basketball on our phones.
Yes, and I think that is the ultimate plan.
Scott Kleinberg writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, Steve.
Have a great weekend,
you
too.
You too.
It's 12:52. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. We're going to talk a little bit about art and innovation, technology, and all mixed together. Ellen Sander is here. She is the principal behind Art to the Nth Degree. Ellen, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Well, thank you. I'm excited.
How did I do with that? Art to the Nth Degree.
Art to the Nth Power. And we are a laboratory.
Nth
a collective.
Power. I told
there
you I don't speak algebra. That's right. You are a collective.
Yes, we're a collective of artists, and we started in 1983, and we produced something we invented called Scholograms, photography, holography, sculpture, and computer graphics.
It is a big day, a busy day for you. There is a seminar going on, Celebrating Women in New Media Arts, hosted by the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and you're speaking there. Well, I'm your warm-up act in a way, right?
Right, because I'm speaking in an hour. And I actually introduced already.
Really?
Yeah,
no kidding.
I've been on several panels.
All right, so again, now I already flubbed Art to the Nth Power.
No, you did not flub. We're creative here.
PHS Scholograms?
Right, Scholograms.
Scholograms, okay.
Holography, sculpture, and computer graphics.
And you have a patent on that.
Yes, and all of the women that are going to be talking today, some of them invented their tools, all of them are leaders in their field, and they're still working artists.
Tell me about, what is a scholagram?
Well, a scholagram looks like a photograph, a backlit photograph, except when you look at it, it's 3D in nature. And it sort of inspired the virtual reality cave. And now everyone's talking about virtual reality. It's become ubiquitous. But in those days, in the 80s and even the 90s, it wasn't.
And how... I'm interested in, and we were talking about this a little bit off the air, you got an MFA in the 70s, right?
I got an MFA in 1975 from the School of the Art Institute in sculpture.
And what's in sculpture? So what you learned then must still be applicable to what you do now, but the tools have completely changed.
Well, what happened is the tools weren't there as far as what I wanted when I realized my dream, and so we invented our dream. We invented the tools so that we can visualize the dream.
Was it always your dream, even before the tools?
No, it was not, actually. It was just, we got commissioned to do a piece, and then after we invented the tools in order to do that one piece, and then after that, we visualized our dreams.
And so are you a precursor, or how are you related to this big explosion in virtual reality?
I am the precursor, not the only one, but one of the people responsible as far as the precursor, because we had an immersive environment in 1983. And of course, NASA was starting to do virtual reality. And then in the 90s, the Electronic Visualization Lab invented the cave. And one of the people one of the women who actually wrote the code for the cave is going to be speaking today.
No
also.
Kidding. Yes. You've worked with NASA.
Yes, I worked. I have many pieces that I've done with NASA.
Tell me about, you know, I talk to a lot of writers, and I'm always interested in the moment of the absolute sort of payoff. Why do you write? When is it great for you? Is it for some people, it's seeing the book on their shelf? For others, it's, you know, turning it into the to the editor. When's the moment for you?
Wow, what a good question. I am in love with process. It's not the final. It is not the final piece. I love the process.
So you've got a piece in the Smithsonian. It's not a big deal for you to walk into the Smithsonian and see
it? I hardly ever. I mean, sure, I walked in and I said, oh, this is a trip. I love this. But that's it. It's a momentary feeling. But the process, it's a long process. And if you're not in love with the process, how can you possibly be an artist?
Yeah.
It's not about fame. Fame, when you win, it comes and goes in a minute. You know that.
Sure, sure.
So it's about the process.
Well, that's nice because there's a lot longer process than there is those moments of fame.
Yes, and to share the tools with everyone is another exciting one.
How much of you is an artist and how much of you is sort of a supplier for business?
Okay. Basically,
get
the
that
truth,
question? Did I make...
Yes, it's a wonderful question, but what really applies to me is I am both an artist and somebody who, because I've been blessed, I give back. I give back as chairman of the Gene Siskel Film Center, as being on the board of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and the Art Institute, and many small arts-related boards, so that artists who are not as blessed financially can also realize their dreams.
Ellen Sandor speaking this afternoon at the symposium, Celebrating Women in New Media Arts. She's one of the big ones, hosted by the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was wonderful to meet you.
Thank
You're listening
you.
To The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.